My father was a World War II vet. During the Depression, he had led men in the Civilian Conservation Corps. In about 1938, they said, why don't you join the Army and get paid a lot more, and you can be a sergeant there. So he went to the 101st and became a sergeant in the Army Air Corps, serving on a boat. I haven't figured all of that out, how the Army Air Corps served on a boat, but that's... and he was a typical baby boomer, and thanks to Dr. Spock, not Mr. Spock from Star Trek, but Dr. Spock, the parents of us baby boomers learned that they should never discipline their children, they should never spank them, they should never even speak harshly to them. If you want them to do anything, you should just speak to the child next to them, so that they'll learn the lesson the easy way. Well, I was a spoiled, rotten kid as a result after the war, as I was born, and my dad wanted me to follow his orders, because remember, he'd been a sergeant, and I was a kid who wanted to do my own thing at my own time, with my own back talk to anything that he happened to say. Now, Dad taught me how to shoot and hunt and camp and cook and do all sorts of things, and taught me discipline. And he sat me down as a young boy and he said there were three things that I needed to learn when I was given an order. When my dad told me to do something, or anyone told me to do something, I should say one of three things. When they asked me the question, either yes, sir, no, sir, or no excuse, sir. And he said, by the way, if it's a sergeant, don't ever call him sir, because they don't like that. But he taught me that, that there's no excuses. And I was full of excuses. I had some really good excuses why I just couldn't do whatever they wanted me to do, because it was hard, because it was a sacrifice, because it was difficult. And so... I thought to myself, I guess maybe I'm not that different than Moses, the character in our study that we're looking at as we go through Exodus. We're in chapter 3, beginning in verse 11. We're going to go through chapter 4, about the same distance today. As we look at excuses, I thought that Moses was giving excuses to God, who told him and commissioned him. Remember the message last Sunday, that he should... go and lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. And Moses wasn't doing it in his defense. He was doing it in defiance of God. Because God's order was very simple. And he should have said, you know, no excuse, sir, I'll do it. I'm not gonna waver. You told me to do it. I will obey. God says it. That settles it. The debate is over. But... more than likely, had we been in Moses' sandals, we'd have done the same thing that he did. And today we want to look at four excuses, because they really do relate to us. As we see the reasoning that God said, I want you to obey my word, I want you to go and do a work for me, just like God tells every one of us. Here, Moses comes up with his excuses as why he shouldn't do what God commanded him to do. So, you have verse 11 of chapter 3 of Exodus. Excuse number one, Moses said in his defense, or as I call it, his defiance, I don't have the right credentials. I lack credentials. Moses said to God, who am I? And later in the verse, he said that I should go to Pharaoh and lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. He was wrongly motivated, but he asked a question worth pondering. You know, he had been the prince of Egypt. He had chosen to identify with the children of Israel. And he was rebuffed. They didn't believe him. They didn't follow him. They were ready to turn him over to the authorities. And he had chosen not to be a son of Pharaoh's daughter any longer. But he still... had lost all realization of who he was. Was he an Egyptian? Was he a Jew? Well, 40 years ago, he had all the answers and nobody listened to him. And now 80 years have gone, another 40 have passed, and he didn't have any identity. I guess you'd get that from being 40 years of chasing sheep around the desert. Pretty soon you say, well, who am I? What can I do? How can God use me? When God commissioned him to deliver the Israelites, I'm sure Moses didn't want to go off half-cocked. He wanted to make sure this was God, this was what he was supposed to do, and had a clear commission. And so he asked these questions. Now, God said, do it. He should have just done it. But his question here, who am I to do this, is one that we ask too. Doesn't that sound like us? I can't go and tell my neighbors about the Lord. I can't talk to my relatives about that. Think how difficult it'll be at Thanksgiving if I start telling them that they're on their way to hell. It's going to be a challenging time. It sounds like you and me. Who am I? God led our little church in Wisconsin to start a Christian school. We went and got some special training, bought land, bought a building, plopped it on there and said, we're going to start a school. The newspaper came to interview me and they said, what education do you have to be in charge of a private parochial school? And I said, well, I have a bachelor's degree, I have a master's degree from seminary. They said, yeah, but those are not accredited, though. Nobody cares about those. What do you have? What kind of real education do you have? And I just kind of swallowed hard and went to the UW as quick as I could and got a couple more degrees from accredited university because I felt like I was Moses. Who am I? Here I am doing this. God called me to do it. But boy, I got a little bit nervous there. And I think that many times when God asks us to act in faith, obeying his word, we want to say to him, Lord, have you looked at my resume lately? Do you really have the right person here? Isn't there someone else? Here am I, Lord, send Aaron. That's the attitude that we have. And I'm sure Moses swallowed hard because he knew that he'd never talk God out of the plan. God said, I want you to go and do it. And he goes, but who am I? So God declares an answer to him in verse 12. That's how we have this simply divided. You'll notice Moses' defense, God's declaration. Four different excuses. If he doesn't have the credentials, God says, I don't care. He doesn't really start it out that way, but he doesn't answer the question. He says, I'll be with you. It doesn't matter who you are or who people think you are. It doesn't matter whether you have the credentials. It doesn't matter whether you have a good reputation, whether you got a bunch of alphabet soup behind your name. If I called you to do something, you do it. And we say, yes, sir. No excuse, sir. We'll do it. Moses said, who am I? And God says, who cares? The question's not who are you, it's who am I, God says. It's who am I. I will be with you. This is a great opportunity for God to deal with Moses' self-esteem issue. Granting the premise of his question, they said, who am I? But denying the conclusion, saying instead, I'll be with you. That's all that matters. Refocus his attention not from the sendee, but to the sender, to God. Because the correct question is, who is God? The correct question is, if God told me to do something, I'm going to obey it because it was God who told me. And I don't know how many times I read in the Bible that I should do this, I should live this way, I should say these things, and then I don't do it for whatever motivation. And it's like God saying, okay, Bob, I want you to look at me. I will be there. It doesn't matter about you. Because we move from a lack of self-reliance to an ungodly lack of faith very quickly. God says, I will be with you, and that we should rest in his promise, and that we should have assurance that he's got a plan. Moses, I've told you to do this. This is what I want you to do. He said, verse 12 continues, this is what the sign means to you. And the sign, by the way, he's talking to him from a burning bush on Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. Okay? He said, this is what the sign means to you, that I've sent you. When you bring the people out of Egypt, you'll serve God in this very mountain, right here, back at Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. You're gonna be back here. You got a burning bush. That's a pretty clear sign. You got God talking to you from the burning bush. You can't kind of say, well, I'm not sure I interpret this correctly. We're not having a debate over punctuation of the Hebrew text here. God said it. I will do it. The promised miracle is of the God who is there in the burning bush who commissioned him. And Moses is thinking, okay, I'm going to come back, but I'm going to be here with a different flock. Not a few thousand sheep from over in Midian down into the wilderness, but with a few million Jews leading them back to this very spot. And by the way, did you realize there's a connection here with how Jesus commissions us? At the end of Matthew, the Great Commission, you're all familiar with it. Jesus says, all power is given to me, all authority, I have it all. What are we to do? Go into the world, preach the gospel, disciple them, baptize them, teach them everything, and I will be there. And lo, I am with you always to the end of the earth. That's the Great Commission, folks. That's exactly what he told Moses. You go, you bring the people here, and I am with you. Because we are Moses in our generation. That we are there to lead people to the truth. And God says, I will be with you. It gives us a wonderful answer to this first whiny little excuse. Well, no, who am I? But that didn't slow Moses down, because Moses was a good, well-trained, educated. He came up with a second excuse in verse 13. A lack of content. He said, God, I don't even know who you are. Okay, who am I? I don't know. But who are you, God? Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they ask me, what is his name? Moses comes up with another pretty good excuse. He said, what am I going to tell them? You see, when God revealed himself to the patriarchs through the book of Genesis, as we go back, remember Exodus is just chapter or section 2 of the story. If we go back, God revealed himself to the different patriarchs of old. And he always said, oh, here's a name. Here's something else that tells you about me. To Abraham in Genesis 14, as he offered tithes to Melchizedek in Salem, he is called the God Most High, El Elyon. And everybody, oh, we know who God Most High is. In Genesis 17, in the covenant with Abraham, God revealed himself as the El Shaddai, the God of the powerful chest, the breasted God. Literally, Shad is the word for breast. The warrior God, the Almighty. In Genesis 21, Abraham came to know him as the everlasting God, El Olam, the God who is for eternity. Isaac, remember God told Abraham, sacrifice your son, he's a teenager. Abraham bound him up, laid him on the altar, and as he was about to kill him, he saw the lamb to take his place, and he named it Yahweh Yireh, Jehovah Jireh, we would say in English. Translation, the Lord provides, the Lord who provides. It tells us about him. See, all the people of the Old Testament all knew God by all these different names because they described what God was doing. Hagar called him El Roy, the God who sees. Jacob called him El Eloha, Israel, the God of his people. In his sense, Jacob's name was Israel, so it was his God. So if Moses' authority is wrapped up in God, he says, what name am I going to give? What am I going to say to these people? They know all the gods of Egypt. Remember, as Joshua ended, he told the people that had moved into the promised land, he said, don't go back and worship the gods of Egypt like the Jews did that were back there in Moses' day. He said, I want to proclaim that I am the God. And Moses said, well, I don't know. I don't understand what I'll say. What will I tell them? Do you have some special cool name that I can say? Here is the God. He wanted to be sure that the elders would believe him, that he had met with the real God, that this burning bush God that's telling him to go and lead the Jews out of Egypt wasn't some demon. You know, there's another fellow down here in the Arabian Peninsula down here who met with a demon. And that demon told him all sorts of things that he should do. The fellow's name was Muhammad. You might have heard of him. And that take the idol, the moon god Allah, and that's the only real God. And he believed it. And look at the mess the world's in. Moses thought, I don't want to make that mistake. By the way, we still have that, don't we? We have people saying, oh, I had God tell me this or God tell me that. Joseph Smith up on the hill Cumorah in upstate New York met in the woods, and he stood there and he saw some sort of an angelic being who told him that he was the prophet that was going to lead the people to a new land. And he listened to the angel Moroni, and we have the Mormons as a result. And we have different groups all along that say, well, God told me this. I felt this. By the way, I have a new revelation from God every night, right after I eat pizza. I'm up half the night, and I'm sure that must be God telling me something. Usually it should be telling me, don't eat pizza before you go to bed. But that's the message that we get from that. Moses says, I don't understand it. He said, what am I going to do if I go there and tell him, you know, what should I say? I don't know. It's like Moses saying, well, you know, I have a friend here that really has a problem. Well, he had a problem. He was wondering what he should say, how he should tell it. And I think that I'm going to have a name for God. It would be not the God who sees or the Almighty God. It would be the God of the insecure, because that's what Moses seems to be at this point in his life. He said, I'm just not sure. He's questioning not who he is, but who God is. So God answers him, and it's a lengthy answer, and we'll just quickly go through the verses here as the chapter winds down. As God's declaration is, you have to trust me. And look at what he said in verses 14 and 15. God said to Moses, I am who I am, Yahweh HaYahweh. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. He didn't come up with some new nickname. He didn't come up with some new catchy phrase, say, ooh, I met the God who is. No. He said, it's the old God. It's the God that's mentioned hundreds of times in the book of Genesis, Yahweh. It's the God of our fathers. He's the one. He is the great I am. That's an odd name. It's an odd construct for us to think of a name that's simply a verbal I am. There's never a time when God wasn't. There's never a time when God won't be. God is the I am, continuous, existent. If you put God on one side of an equation, I'm not real good at math, but let me try and figure it out here on the board. If you have God on one side and an equal sign, what would you put on the other side? God is what?
Love, right?
Oh, yeah, the world loves that one. Ah, no pun. God is love. And he is, right? But if it's a real equal sign here, then you should be able to reverse it, right? Love is God. No, that's not going to work. Because instead of an equal sign, boy, I'm telling you, I got math teachers looking at me like, what are you doing here, preacher? Get with the Hebrew or something. Is that the greater than? God is greater. Keep wanting to sing. I feel a VeggieTales song coming on here. God is greater than the boogeyman or whatever it is. God is greater than love. God is greater than anything. There is, if you have God equals, there can only be God on the other side. The I am. That's it. That we can understand here. This is not a new name. 160 times in Genesis, God calls himself Yahweh. So Moses said, okay, I'm getting the picture here. This is the name you want me to take back. The one name. If anybody ever asks you, what's God's real name? What's his pet name? What's the name that, you know, he's going to always answer to? El Shaddai, El Elyon, El Halom. It's Yahweh. Four little letters. YHWH in our English, if we were to transliterate the Hebrew letters, YHWH. And that's it. He said, that's all you need to know. Do you think Moses knew that name? Do you think he learned that from his mother, Yahweh? God has blessed. That God is, Yahweh, actually, God is my glory. Yahweh is my glory. That was his mother's name. I think she maybe shared that with her baby boy. And so that Moses, as a boy, learned all about Yahweh. That he is the one. Isaiah said in Isaiah 40, 28, have you not known, have you not heard that Yahweh, the everlasting God, the creator of the world, doesn't faint or grow weary. And his understanding is unsearchable. God is completely different. And so Moses is listening. Okay, I'm talking not to some angel, not to some demon, not to some being here and I'm having a vision. I'm talking to the God who is there. Yahweh. If you wonder who Yahweh that talked to him is, listen to him speaking other places other than in the burning bush. In John 8, he said, therefore I said to you that you'll die in your sins, for if you don't believe Yahweh, that I am Yahweh, you'll die in your sins. Who said that? Jesus. John 8, 28, Jesus said, when you lift up the Son of Man, you'll know Yahweh. It'll be translated that I am. You'll know him. John 8, 58. Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am Yahweh. The Yahweh of the New Testament is the Lord Jesus Christ. As he said it over and again in John 18, Jesus knowing in the garden when he was being betrayed and arrested, he knew all things would come. He went to the group saying, who are you seeking? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said, Yahweh, I am. And Judas, who betrayed him and stood with them, and when he said, I am, they stepped backwards and fell to the ground. See, the New Testament shows us it's his name, and it always will be his name. For Malachi 3:6 says, I am, Yahweh, will never change. So Moses is given a little theology lesson here. Okay, who am I talking to? I know who God is. I know his name. We need to trust him. We need to proclaim him. Verses 16 and 17 go on and say, as Yahweh talks to him, saying, go and gather the elders of Israel together. Say to them, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I've observed you and what's been done to you in Egypt. And I promise I'll bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. God says, you're going to go, you're going to tell them that it's my authority, I am Yahweh, and the good news has come. After 400 years, you're getting out. You're ready to go and conquer the land. Awesome message. I'm not sure every Jew in Egypt wanted to hear a message exactly like that. They were crying. They didn't want to be working so hard. They didn't want to be servants and slaves to the Egyptians. But they didn't necessarily want to go out into the desert for a few years and then go fight a war for 7 years to conquer another land. I'm thinking most of the Jews are pretty comfortable if they'd just had their lifestyle just upgraded a little bit. Just make it a little easier for us. But he said, no, you proclaim my message. This is the truth. You're going to go. And God said in verses 18 to 20, they will listen to your voice. And you and the elders of Israel will go to the king of Egypt and you'll tell him this. Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we might sacrifice to Yahweh our God. And then God says, oh, but I know the king of Egypt won't let you go unless he's compelled to by a powerful hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt and all the wonders that I will do in it, and then he'll let you go. Moses was to take this message. He said, you take the message that I'm God, this is what I want you to do. You take it to the Jews, they're going to believe you. You do it first to them, and then I'm going to take you to Pharaoh. And you'll give him a small request. It won't be a hard one for him to just say, okay, we'll let them go out there for a little while. And by the way, 3 days is a Hebrew idiom. Are you familiar with idioms of the language that we use? Like when you say something, you know, I'll see you in a couple days. How long is a couple? Well, two would be couple, right? That makes sense. But a couple days? I usually make sure people know. I always say a couple of three or a couple of four or something like that. For the Hebrews, when they say, 3 days, 3 nights, that means a while. Isn't that nice, specific? It means anything more than 1 day and anything less than one cycle of the moon, 29 days. So I'll see you in a while. I'll see you in 3 days and 3 nights. I'm sure that Moses is thinking, boy, if I tell that to Pharaoh, he's not gonna let us go out. I mean, in 29 days, we can leave Goshen, and in 29 days, we can lead 2 million people. We can be right up here at the borders of Canaan and the Philistines and be ready to go. He's not going to let that. Pharaoh had within his power, but he wouldn't do it. And God says, I know that, but I want to show my power. And as a result, as the chapter concludes in verses 21 and 22, he says, you're going to be blessed beyond what you know. I will give the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you won't go out empty. Each woman will ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry, for clothing. You'll put them on your children, your sons, your daughters, and you'll plunder the Egyptians. God says, I'm going to change their hearts. They don't want to let you go. But I'm going to make it so miserable that they'll have to let you go. They'll be so happy to let you go, they'll give you money to leave. Now, Moses is thinking, okay, if I tell this to the Jews, they're going to accept that. If there's money involved, okay, we're going to get rich. Not that they're forcing the Egyptians. It's like they're collecting back wages for 420 years of misery and service. And so Moses recognize that this money talk would be a good blessing to them. So he's thinking, okay, I asked God, who am I? And God says, it doesn't matter. I'll be with you. I said, God, well, who are you? And now he tells me it's the old God, the God that everybody knows, Yahweh, that's been there since the book of Genesis all the way through. Every story we tell, every passage, we know exactly what it is. Moses is thinking on his feet, or maybe on his knees, because he's still in front of the burning bush here, talking to God. And he says, I just don't want to do this. I've got to come up with another excuse. Excuse number three that we all are good at is a lack of converts. Nobody's going to believe me. Nobody's going to follow me. I can't do this, Lord. Are you looking at the right person here? Exodus 4. We turn the page now to chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answered, this is his third excuse. But suppose they won't believe me or listen to me. What if God's wrong? God said, you go, I'll be with you. They will believe you. And Moses is going, well, what if they don't? You say, how come Moses reminds me of my six-year-old? How come, you know, you can almost hear the whine in his voice. Why? Why, Lord? What if God said, have confidence in me. I can do this. Look at this. I'm in a burning bush talking to you. You're sitting out here in the middle of the desert. I've given you an order. What else matters? And he said, well, what if they don't believe me? What if they say, well, Yahweh didn't really appear to you? Moses wanted respect. Moses wanted to be, remember, he came out of Egypt. He wanted to be thought of as this powerful leader. And he says, what if they don't believe me? What if they don't give me the respect? What if they don't... And I'm thinking to myself, Moses, what respect does a messenger have? I got a letter a couple weeks ago. I don't even know the mailman. I don't even know if it's a man. The mail person's name. Because who delivered the letter doesn't really matter. It's who the letter was from and what it said. And I looked at that letter and I saw it was from my dear friends at the IRS. And they, yeah, that's coming up this week too, by the way. It's not just Palm Sunday and Easter. It's April 15th coming up very quickly. And I got this letter. I don't know any, I don't care about the messenger. I care about what it said. Because I got a letter once from the government that I thought, I don't care what it says. And it said, your friends and neighbors have selected you to join the military. Called a draft letter during Vietnam. And I said, I'm not going to do that. We won't go into that story at this particular time. But Moses is doing, and he's doing it in his best Rodney Dangerfield voice. Okay, I don't get no respect. Nobody's going to believe me. And who cares if they believe the messenger or not? God says, I want them to believe the message. I am God. I'm going to do this miracle. You tell them and you lead them. R.C. Sproul was asked what the greatest need is for America, non-Christians in America. And he said, they need to know what God is like. Everybody stopped him and said, yeah, I can see that. He said, what about the greatest need of Christians? And he said, they need to know what God is like. That's what we need. We need to know God. We need to, and not the messenger. They don't like me. They don't want to listen to my message. Boo-hoo, Moses. He just needed to know that God was in control and God was going to do it, and it didn't matter whether the people listened to him or not. God was the powerful God who does the miracles. You say, well, it doesn't make sense. They've been servants and raising their families. Now they're down to the level of just about serfs or slaves in Egypt, and they're miserable, but that's the only life they've known. They've been there 420 years now. They said, I don't understand. And Moses is kind of like a mule, and you all know how hard it is to reason with a mule. And a farmer that we knew that had one said that he said the first thing when you come up to a mule and you want it to do some work is you take out a 2x4 and you hit it right in the middle of its eye, just whack it over the head. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, the mule doesn't understand what you're trying to do, but it'll get his attention. And that's all God needed to do for Moses here. Whack him upside the head with a spiritual 2x4 and say, you go and you do the work. Because I am in charge. I am the all-powerful Yahweh. Moses doesn't catch it. So God answers him in verses 2 and through 5. Yahweh said to him, okay, Moses, what's in your hand? He said, a staff. God said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground. It became a serpent, and Moses stepped back from it. Yahweh said to Moses, put out your hand and catch it by the tail. By the way, if you've ever, do not try this at home. If you're ever going to catch a poisonous snake, you don't pick it up by the tail and have it whip around. And I mean, that's just crazy. And Moses, who stepped back from that snake, God said, reach out and do it. And in parentheses, he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff again in his hand, that they might believe that Yahweh, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. God said, I'm going to use you, but you don't matter. I'm the one with the power. I'm the one that can change lives. I'm the one that can take this hopeless situation in Egypt and change it. When I tell people the gospel, I don't give them some false promises and say, well, you know, God will heal you of all your diseases. You'll never be sick. We have friends who believe they're never going to die. Christian friends. They've been taught in their church up in Montana that they will never, never die. And when they get sick, they call Teresa, thank you, and we give them stuff. But you know what? I'm just going to share this with you as just a little aside. They're going to die. But I can share with them the truth that God can change a heart. God can change a sinner rebellious against him on the way to hell happily. And God can turn that life around and redeem them and change them into one who worships God, who repents of their sins and believes the gospel. I can't do that, but God can. That's a greater miracle than a healing. That's a greater miracle than having all the health and wealth. Man, that's a greater miracle than the letter from the IRS that said I overpaid. I didn't finish that story, so I wanted to. And there was a check. And I said, okay. Now, it was my money that I'd given them and they'd used for free for a whole year, but that's the American mentality. Whoa, I got money back. This is fantastic. Wait a minute. God says, I want to use you, but I'm the one with the power. I can do it. See, what we have in our hand doesn't really matter. You say, well, I don't have a good voice, or I don't have a great ability. I don't have a lot of knowledge. I don't have a lot of friends. I don't have people that like me. I don't get no respect. We can play Moses' game if you'd like here. God says, does it matter? What did David have in his hand? A shepherd's sling and 5 stones? Goliath, by the way, had 4 other giant brothers. And David was just prepared in case they came out after Goliath was killed. He was going to, 5 stones would be good enough. What did Shamgar have in his hand? The judges. You're probably talking about him on the way to church today. Ox goad. Yeah, pointed stick. What did Samson use to kill the Philistines? Yeah, jawbone of an ass. And if God can use a jawbone of an ass, there's hope for me. Wait a minute, that doesn't sound good. God can do this. Little boy, everybody had eaten their lunch and listened to Jesus all day long, and they were hungry, and Jesus said, send the people away, and they said, nobody's got any food. Nobody, they can't buy it anywhere. There's nothing. One little boy still had his lunch. Some little barley bagels, some little perch-like fish. What is that? What's in your hand, little boy? not much. And God does the miracles. That staff, that rod of God that Moses had in his hand, he threw it down, it became a serpent, he picked it up, it became a staff again. That's the one that he's going to hold up over the Red Sea and the waters are going to split apart. That's the one that he's going to take and whack against a rock when the people are dying of thirst in the wilderness and water's going to gush out. That's the one that when the Amalekites come and fight his people and they're in a battle, he's going to stand up on the hill and lift it up before God, and the people will prevail. And when he puts the rod down, they'll start losing. And so Aaron and Hur stand on either side of him and hold up his arms so they can hold the rod, because it's a symbol of God's power. The power to change things, the power, the authority. What's in your hand is the question God asks. The world today says, what's in your wallet, right? Again, pick up verse 6. Realize your humility. You want to see the power of God? We just saw a staff turned into a snake and back into a staff again. Yahweh said to him, put your hand inside your cloak. And he put his hand inside, and when he took it out, behold, it was full of leprosy. The most feared, debilitating disease of his day. He looked at it, it's all white with the sores and leprosy. God says, okay, put it back inside your coat. I'm sure Moses is going, I want to cut that thing off. I don't want this. Moses put it back inside his coat. And when he took it out, behold, it was restored just like the rest of his flesh. God said in verse 8, if they won't believe you or listen to the first sign, they'll believe the second sign. If they won't believe these two signs, my snake sign, leprosy sign, the disease sign, he said, then take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. And the water that you pour out onto the ground will pool up and it'll turn into blood. God says, I am a miracle working God. They will believe me. You don't count, Moses. You just obey what I told you to do. Because when God speaks, everyone listens. God's power is there. A friend of mine once said that he was going to try to please God by doing more and more good works. That he would get better and better at his life until he made it to heaven. And I said, you really think you have the power to overcome your own sin and the power to live a perfect life so that God will take you to heaven? I said, you don't even have the power to get over a cold. You don't even have the power to quit sneezing with the allergies. And you think you can deal with sin? God says, I've got miracles for you here, Moses. Not just a burning bush. We've got the snake. We've got the leprosy. We've got water turning into blood. Now, water into wine is a good miracle, okay? But water into blood, this is talking about the judgment of God that's going to come. And we all know, because I'm sure you've all heard the stories of the plagues of Egypt, and we're going to get to that somewhere down the line here in the next few chapters, that God's going to actually do that very first miracle. He's going to turn the waters of the Nile into blood. Because if the miracles of transformation don't work, the miracle of judgment is going to happen. I would hope Moses would say, okay, Lord, I'm ready. Let's go. But sadly, verse 10 picks up the fourth excuse. Because Moses, I love the way it starts, but, can you hear that whiny sound? But Moses said to Yahweh, oh, my Lord, I'm not articulate either before or after you've spoken to me. He went on to say, I'm slow of speech and tongue. He said, I can't say the right thing. I don't understand. How am I going to be able to talk to these Jews? the phrase that's used here, I translate as articulate. What did some of your own translations?
Eloquent.
I'm not eloquent? Okay. It's a Hebrew word saying I don't understand the language. Now think about it. He's been out of Egypt for 40 years. He's been over in Midian talking to sheep, talking the Aramaic, the language of the land. He says, I'm going to go back there and I got to talk Hebrew to the Jews and I got to go and talk Egyptian to the Pharaoh. He said, I can't do it. He uses this Hebrew word that I translate inarticulate, but it's literally, it's I'm heavy of mouth. When I open my mouth, the right words won't come out. I can't say what needs to be said. I'm not competent. I'm not educated enough. I'm slow of speech and of tongue, which, by the way, is a lie. Acts 7:22, when Stephen preaches about Moses, he said that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and mighty in word and deed. He was a great speaker. Moses is grasping at straws as he keeps whining and trying to excuse himself from doing what God wants him to do. Why? I believe he's scared to death. All of a sudden, his life is changed. And he is absolutely fearful. He's psychological. I'm sure that he's standing there stammering to God, I can't do it. I can't come up with the words. I don't understand it. I'm slow. God says, I want you to do something. He will use slow speech. He'll use people that don't understand the language. He'll use people that haven't had all the education, that don't have the, you know, PhD or THD or TwiddleDD or whatever they have behind their name, you know, for degrees in education. He says, it, you know, I understand, you're scared. Paul said to the church in Corinth in 2 Corinthians 3:5, not that we're sufficient in ourselves. Our sufficiency is of God. In Ephesians 3:8, he says to me, though I'm the least of the saints. And remember, Paul had this PhD from the greatest Hebrew schooling possible. He said, though I'm the least of the saints, grace was given to me to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, of the Messiah. So God rebukes Moses with this last excuse and straightens him out one final time. For in verse 11, then Yahweh said to him, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, Yahweh? Moses, you're being guilty of irreverence to God. God says, if I chose you, does it matter that you can't speak? I handle it all. Remember the disciples coming with Jesus and seeing a man who was blind from birth? And they stopped and they asked Jesus and they said, is this because of his sin or his parents? They wanted some reason for this man who'd been blind all his life. Why was he blind? And Jesus said, he's blind to give glory to God. You ever look in a mirror and say, God, why did you make me this way? Why did you make me, you know, bigger, smaller, fatter, thinner, a male, a female, of one nationality or ethnicity or another, rich or poor? I look in the mirror and I say, God, why did you make me with such a big nose? Couldn't you make me with just a little, you know, God, you just didn't do the best job here. And then I hear the 2x4 coming because God needs to get my attention. And I back away from the mirror, take off my glasses, and I look good. I can't see a thing. I look great. God says, don't be irreverent. Don't say, well, why, Lord, you know, you made me this way. God says, I am in charge. I am sovereign. I'm so almighty that what you are doesn't matter. Get your eyes off of yourself. Get your excuses off of what you think and simply obey me. Yes, sir. No excuse, sir. I'll do it. Paul wrote again to the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians 2. He said, when I came to you the first time, proclaiming the testimony of God, I didn't come with lofty speech or wisdom. I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness, in fear, in shaking. My speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but simply a demonstration of the Spirit and the power, so that your faith won't rest in the wisdom of men, but it'll rest in the power of God. 1 Corinthians 2, 1-5. Well, I need to read that every day. That this is the way God wants us to see. He said, I made you. Trust me. You can do the work. And he concludes in verse 12 and says, therefore, go and I'll be with your mouth and I'll teach you what you should say. He says, don't be irrelevant. Don't be irreverent to begin with, but don't be irrelevant here. You don't understand. You don't have the words. You're fearful. All these excuses. He said, just go. I'll be there. I'll tell you what to say. You can do it. If Moses was a poor speaker, was that news to God? Does Moses really think God made a mistake here? God says, hey, it's time for speech therapy. I'll take care of you. We'll make it work. It's as if God was saying, Moses, you've given me four excuses, and I have a four-letter word for them. It's the word lame. But they're the same excuses we all give. Moses, I'll be your mouth. Moses, I'll be sufficient. Moses, I will do more than you can imagine. Someone asked me at our 50th class reunion, did I ever imagine I would be at this stage of life? I said, I didn't think I would live to see a 50th class reunion to begin with. But I never imagined what God would do. I look back with awe. I look back with wonder and say, look at God, what you did. You gave me this. You did this for me. You allowed me to minister here. You gave me a wonderful wife. You gave me great kids. You gave me above average grandchildren. Have I showed you a picture lately? You've given me all these different things. I can look back and rejoice. And my inadequacies pale. My self-image falls down at my knees. It said, no. It's all God. So today, we say, I'd love to serve God, but I want to obey Him, but I'm going to live for His glory. I'm going to share the gospel, but in politics, you run for something. In Christianity, most of us run away. We come up with these same excuses. I don't know who I am. I don't have any ability. I don't know who God is. What's going to happen? I don't know what He wants me to say. I'm not confident. I'm not respected. I'm not eloquent. I'm not confident. And God says, get your eyes off of your weaknesses. Get a vision of me. Proclaim my word. Recognize that I will be with you. Recognize that you don't have the power. I do. And be thankful when God says, I've got a task for you that's above your ability. It's above your pay grade. I got work for you to do and you can do it. The story told by Chuck Swindoll that he taught his little grandson how to tie shoes. Now, we don't have to do that anymore because it's 1-2 Velcro my shoe. You know, it's not hard. You don't have to teach him how to tie that. But he said, I taught my grandson how to tie his shoes. And he worked at it to make the little bunny ears and flip it. You know, you all know how to make a bow. And he'd try like that. And he'd get it into a knot. And he'd keep going and get it into a bigger knot. And then he'd get frustrated. And so he'd grab each end as hard as he could and pull it as hard as he could to get rid of that knot. Yeah, you know where the illustration's going here, don't you? Because it only made it tighter. And Chuck Swindoll said in the story, he said there's many times that the only answer was the scissors. And I thought of a little poem. With thoughtlessness and impatient hands, we tangle up the plans that the Lord has wrought. And when in pain we cry or complain, he says, be quiet, child, while I untie the knot. God's given us work to do. And if you don't think you can do it, good. You can't. But God can.